Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I have the distinct pleasure today of interviewing Dr. Megan McKenzie about her book titled Good Soldiers Don't Rape, The Stories We Tell About Military Sexual Violence, published by Cambridge University Press. This is, I think, an interesting book and a very important book to help us understand why sexual violence is such a problem within so many, particularly Western militaries. The book focuses on the US, Canada, and Australia, to help us understand like what's going on with this, what's actually happening, how people are talking about it, how these things go together to create theories around sexual violence that probably aren't necessarily that helpful. So this is a really useful book, I think, for helping us understand all sorts of things about militaries, about gender, about feminism. So Megan, thank you so much for being with us to tell us all about it.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Before we get into your book, would you mind giving us a bit of an introduction to yourself and explaining what brought you to this project?
Yeah. So my name is Megan McKenzie. My pronouns are she, her. I am the Simons Chair in International Law and Human Security at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. I'm speaking to you from Indigenous lands, from the lands of the Coast Salish peoples. What brought me to write this book, essentially I've been looking at and doing research on military culture for over a decade now. And when I was starting looking originally at issues around women in combat, and I've done research on military suicide, various issues, essentially sexual violence in the military was very much an ever-present theme. It was the elephant in the room in every single discussion. Almost every woman I've ever spoken to who has served has either experienced sexual violence or supported fellow service members dealing with sexual violence. And I felt like, I resisted writing the book, to be honest, or writing on this topic for a long time, because I felt like it was just such an important issue and I sort of felt underqualified. But essentially, I sort of felt compelled to address the issue in the way that I knew how, which was to approach it through an analysis of media coverage.
So tell us about that approach. Why do you think that approaching this topic through an analysis of media coverage is particularly sort of helpful for exploring this topic?
Yeah, well, I think, so I'll talk about the limitations for me of other approaches. I mean, I think that, of course, there's a very valid approach where you could study this topic or bring through victim testimonies. And I really felt conflicted about that approach. And I talk about it in my introduction, just around the challenge of doing service to victims' stories. And I just didn't feel qualified to approach the topic that way. And instead, I guess the main puzzle I grapple with in this book that I think media coverage helps me with is really how it's possible that militaries remain the most trusted public institution in most Western countries, including Canada, including the UK, including the US, despite evidence of ongoing crisis and ongoing scandals when it comes to not just sexual violence, but when it comes to war crimes, when it comes to hazing and bullying and other systematic evidence of dysfunction. So for me, I was interested in, what are the public conversations? How are we making sense of ongoing evidence of sexual violence in the military? So I thought media coverage would be the best place to go for that, to sort of look at how is this issue being covered and how is it possible to sort of consistently represent evidence of sexual violence, especially outstanding cases, as if they're scandals, even though, actually rates of sexual violence within militaries have been sort of high and increasing and consistent over the last few decades. So I wanted to understand how is the media making sense of it? How are militaries responding to evidence of sexual violence? The media for me was the best place to look. It's really the public's main tool for getting information about the military. There's such a divide, a separation between the military and civilian world. And so the media is really, I think, the best place to look for that.
Thank you. I think that makes a lot of sense and helps us now dive into your analysis. So one of the places I'd like to start is a term you use, military exceptionalism. Can you take us through what you mean by this term and why it's helpful for understanding this problem?
Yeah, so military exceptionalism is really the core concept that I develop in the book. And really, it's kind of captures this paradox, the paradoxical way that we look at the military as both, honorable and disciplined, but also capable of acts of indiscipline. So it helps me understand why, for example, acts like war crimes or sexual violence are presented as sort of unfortunate but natural byproducts of an otherwise honorable system. So we think of military exceptionalism as not just this way that we see the military as unique and a unique workplace, but how that idea of military exceptionalism kind of lets service members off the hook for persistent evidence of dysfunction. And I really rely on Shireen Razak's work here to help us sort of look at how sometimes actually acts of indiscipline, so sexual violence or even war crimes, are sort of seen as natural signs of soldiers sort of letting off steam or the natural byproducts of the stress of being a service member. So I sort of developed that concept throughout the book.
And therefore, that's why we're starting with it, so that you can develop it over the course of the interview as well. I was really curious, I think, coming in to see what similarities we might find across the media coverage, given that in some ways, the US, Canada, and Australia are really similar in terms of how the military is treated, but also they're three different countries and have had three very different sort of military histories and involvements in different conflicts. So I was kind of wondering whether there'd be sort of any overarching similarities or whether, I don't know anything about this topic. Maybe that's completely off the mark. But I read in the book that you do identify sort of three meta narratives that come up in each of the cases and even across time. So could you introduce us to these three meta narratives?
Yeah. So essentially what I do in the book is look at 30 years of media coverage in these three case countries. And I was looking for themes. I was looking for, you know, common language, different tools. But I was also, you know, as you so say, I was really looking for what are the stories that are being told consistently. And there are unique stories to each of the case countries, the US, Canada, and Australia. But there are three sort of overarching sort of, and when I say stories, I'm saying, I'm really referring to how sexual violence in the military is being made sense of. What is sort of being naturalized in a particular article and a particular series of articles. So the three kind of meta narratives that I found, the first one is really this story that sexual violence is a natural, if unfortunate, kind of byproduct of military culture. And this is this idea that, you know, if we want to have tough, ready for combat soldiers, inevitably we're going to have a group of men that may commit types of violence, that may sort of explode or may find it difficult to contain that exceptional energy. And this is a different version of Boys Will Be Boys. I guess it's a version of Soldiers Will Be Soldiers. And it really, again, touches on that idea of military exceptionalism. It's this idea that, you know, to have good soldiers, we can expect or we should normalize a certain level of dysfunction in the military that includes sexual violence. So that's the first one. The second is sort of this meta narrative that, you know, basically women who join defense forces are kind of putting themselves at risk. You know, sort of there was a consistent kind of questioning of why would women want to be there, and women who are there are going to be isolated, are going to be vulnerable, and they should know what they're getting into. And in some ways, this puts the pressure on or the responsibility on women for joining the service, and, you know, kind of presents women as the problem and not men, that sort of we didn't have sexual violence before. Women were, you know, in such high numbers in defense forces. And also, again, reinforces this idea that men can't be expected to control themselves around women. And then the last kind of meta narrative, and again, this sort of goes back to this concept of military exceptionalism, is really the message that only the military and military leaders know how to handle the problem of sexual violence. So it sort of puts, you know, public questions or reactions to sexual violence as if they're sort of overreaction, maybe even hysterical. And really reinforces this idea that, you know, we have it covered, that the military is best placed to deal with the sort of exceptional workplace environment.
Hmm. Very interesting that those are what's consistent over space and time. And I think it's kind of the time point I'd love to ask you a bit more about. Was there a pattern or cycle that this 30 years of analysis, I mean, that's just a massive amount to analyze, first off. Congratulations for getting through all of that. But were there any sort of patterns or cycles that you found on these topics?
Yeah, so across the three cases, there's a really clear pattern. And the pattern is that we basically pay no attention to this issue publicly until there is a scandal. And each of the case countries, and I'm sure in the UK, you know, there's different cases come to mind. And for whatever reason, there'll be a high profile case. And it's usually high profile because of the exceptional circumstances, because it involves a senior member of the defense forces. Some element of the case makes it exceptional. And usually we see a very, you know, an uptake in media coverage on the topic, military leaders, and sometimes even the government, depending on how high profile the scandal is, making statements of zero tolerance and making new commitments, sometimes commitments to policy change. And then we go back to almost no attention to this issue. So if you look at media coverage over time in the three countries, you sort of see these dramatic spikes in numbers of articles focused on this topic. And they really center on single scandals. And what's interesting about that is, you know, statistics and the rates of sexual violence are very consistent across these 30 years. So even when sexual violence stays high over time, the public really doesn't pay attention to this issue until there's something particularly scandalous about it.
Until there's something particularly scandalous about it, which is really interesting, because kind of what counts as a scandal, what counts as a problem, is an issue that you talk about in the book. So can you tell us about some of the problems that we have when it comes to kind of defining, like, how big a problem is this? How frequently does it happen? We don't even have that data. Why not?
Well, I think it's because military institutions have historically been terrible at collecting data on sexual violence. So Australia and Canada really didn't even begin to collect useful data in Canada until around, you know, not until 2015. In Australia, it was sort of around 2011. And in the past, you know, in Australia, for example, sexual violence was sort of, any incidents of sexual violence was sort of captured in a broader category of misconduct. So being drunk on post or other kinds of misconduct were all collected together. So we really didn't have effective data. And defense forces have collected data differently year to year, which makes it difficult to compare and to see trends. We also have the problem of victims within the service being reluctant to come forward. So even when we have incident reports, we know from research that it's likely that 80% of victims do not come forward at all. So even for the incident reports that we do have in the more recent years, they're very likely to be highly underrepresentative of actual numbers of incidents of sexual violence. So it's very hard to understand the problem. That being said, we do have enough evidence to know that it's a significant problem. So for example, 1 in 4 service members in Australia report experiencing some form of sexual violence. In Canada, we've just had, you know, 3 years of consistent problems with senior military leaders. We've had 13 senior military leaders, including 2 chief of the defense forces, facing allegations of sexual violence and a class action lawsuit around sexual violence in the military that's seen 20,000 victims come forward, historic victims come forward. So we know it's a significant problem, even with the poor data that we have. And so it is interesting with all of that to sort of grapple with which cases become seen as significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we have enough of an idea of kind of what the problem is and how the cases go together in a sense to start going into some of the detail for each of the countries. So could you tell us about what some of the consistent stories are around military sexual violence, specifically in the US media? And I am asking about the US first, because that's the first case study you go into in the book. Why did you put it first?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really clear in the US case that what's interesting about US media coverage is that essentially US media coverage has much more of a global impact than the Canadian media coverage or Australian. We know that, for example, the New York Times is a globally read news source, has a much wider readership, but also we know that the stories that we tell about the American military also has global purchase. There's a sort of global presence of the US military, but also the sort of public the pop culture representations and the popular narratives around the U.S. military are much more global. That's we see movies about the U.S. military that have an international impact. So really, the stories we tell about the U.S. military are global in a way that actually other militaries, you know, we can't say the same thing. So I put it first because I do think that what's happening in the U.S. has an impact beyond its borders. And I talk about that, how some of the sort of, you know, major cases definitely impacted media coverage in other countries. In terms of the specifics of the U.S. Case, so one of the major scandals, there's some major scandals that shaped, I guess, media coverage there. So Tailgate happened in the early 90s, and it was a huge conference that saw dozens of women being sexually assaulted, and it really shaped media coverage for a decade. And that kind of the way that that particular scandal was talked about has a legacy. And what's interesting is some of the legacies of that. One of the, I would say, ones that dominates U.S. media narratives ongoing is this idea that women lie to ruin good men's honorable careers. And that's a narrative that's not really as dominant in other countries. We don't see that as much. But this idea that, you know, women in the defense forces are raising allegations potentially to discredit someone who has, you know, served their country to ruin, you know, or to ruin the reputation of the military more broadly. So that was something that comes up quite consistently, this idea that these allegations may be designed to sort of harm otherwise honorable men. I think in the U.S., the other sort of dominant, and I've written about the Band of Brothers narrative and how pervasive it is in the U.S., is just this idea that actually the Band of Brothers, meaning service members and their bonds, that service members will protect themselves, and that this bro code provides service members with sort of a network and a way to get away with sexual violence, that service members protect each other, that there's this code of silence when it comes to court cases. So that idea of the impact of the Band of Brothers on sexual violence cases really comes through in media coverage.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
And as you said, has quite a lot of impact overseas as well. So thinking about some of the overlap moving to Australia, I was really interested at two of the terms you used to describe the coverage of military sexual violence: paradoxical and contradictory. Can you take us through them in the case of Australia?
Yeah, the Australian case, and you know, I lived in Australia for 10 years, so I have quite a good sense of the media culture, and I think, you know, we have a sense of you know, the Murdoch media sort of dominance in that country means that the variation in terms of media outlets and the independence of media outlets is really different from other contexts. And so, and also the tone of media coverage is quite different. And there's much more casual language, colloquialisms, slang. that's used. The op-eds, I would say, are very colorful sometimes. I guess that's the word I would use, to the most appropriate word. Something that I think would never get published, for example, in the Canadian context. So I guess the paradoxical nature is just, you know, I think I may slightly misquote it, but one of the quotes that I found, a military leader, who was quoted, said, with regard to sexual violence, it's pervasive, but it's not a problem. And for me, that kind of captures Australian media coverage, is this idea that there's this paradox of admitting to the problem, but also having this counter narrative of control. And I was never quite sure how that was possible, but you see it come through one of the dominant narratives in media coverage. There is, everything's okay. You know, there's this problem, but everything is okay. We're committed to change. And so the other kind of paradoxical meta narrative in the Australian context is this idea that military culture is dysfunctional by nature, but it should be respected and it's still admirable. And that sort of this idea that, you know, it's because of the, you know, again, going to military exceptionalism, because of the unique nature of the military, sure, we have some, you know, bad apples or signs of dysfunction, but it's actually just part of an otherwise kind of admirable, and honorable institution. So we just constantly have paradoxes in the Australian media context that are sustained.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a really good sort of, it really helps make those words, make a lot of sense. I suppose, I mean, is there anything, one thing that came through in the book is that I guess part of the paradox is that there's also sort of some really consistent messages across the different Australian narratives, despite their contradictory nature. Can you tell us about kind of the consistency and maybe why it's there?
Sure. I mean, one thing I do want to say about the Australian context that really stands out is how much binge drinking is an emphasis in media coverage. And I guess this does go to this paradox in the sense that there's this continual admission that binge drinking is a problem, but also that it's an essential and sort of acceptable part of military culture. And it's often attributed to a sexual assault. In other words, there's this persistent message that binge drinking was the cause, or at least a rationale to help explain an incident of sexual assault. And I guess that's for me, it really stood out because it sort of points to how acceptable binge drinking has been for decades in Australia. And also that it's sort of, you know, again, seen as the cause of sexual assault in some way, rather than perpetrators.
I think that, especially with Australia, as you mentioned, the fact that you had lived there for such a long time and could kind of interpret the media culture allows an especially interesting level of analysis, as you said, kind of the acceptance of binge drinking. And that's not just something for this one type of story. Similarly, when you look at the Canadian case, you draw links between kind of what's happening around the media discourse for stories about military sexual assault specifically, but also kind of a wider way that bad things, negative things are discussed across the media and in conversation kind of throughout Canadian culture, even on other topics. Can you tell us about sort of what you think is going on here?
Yeah, and I think, again, I do think having lived in both, you know, in all three of the case countries, it does give me a sense. And certainly since I've moved back to Canada after being in Australia for a decade, I have, a good insight into the difference between the Australian context and the Canadian context. And what I sort of say in the intro to the Canadian case study is that I try and summarize the Canadian approach to problems as sort of this tight-lipped, it's fine approach. And I think, I do think it's an accurate portrayal of this resistance to sort of messy conversations. You know, while the Australian context, we have sort of quite, I would say, passionate and casual op-eds and a very colloquial way of talking about the problem. In the Canadian context, there's much more of a tight-lipped kind of, we've got this approach to military sexual violence. And so you have very different narratives. So in particular, I would say military sexual violence wasn't even identified as a political or as a systemic problem in media coverage until the late 90s. And then really not again until 2015, when there was another sort of series of scandals. So some of the narratives in Canada, most of the coverage really focuses on court cases. It's presented as a complex problem. Sort of this is a difficult problem that's going to take time. And it's another sort of standout narrative in the Canadian context is that military sexual violence is a source of embarrassment for an institution. That this is actually the problem of sexual violence is that it embarrasses the institution. That not that it's a problem for victims necessarily, but that it's an institutional sort of shame. So I think those are sort of the different contexts. It's also a different context in the sense that we've had in the Canadian context one news magazine, Maclean's magazine, that really actually set the tone for the conversations around sexual violence because they published two massive exposés on systemic sexual violence. And I honestly think that had it not been for that media outlet sort of doing that deep investigative journalism, it probably wouldn't have, you know, there would not have been as much attention to the issue.
Mm. Yeah, which really says something about kind of the willingness or lack thereof to talk about this, which continues with another term that you use in the book that I'm hoping you can tell us about, institutional gaslighting.
Yeah, so institutional gaslighting was the concept I drew from really to help me understand, you know, this idea, again, going to that quote, it's persistent but not a problem. I mean, for me, that's the perfect example of institutional gaslighting. And what I mean by gaslighting, of course, when we think of gaslighting, we think of this idea of efforts to undermine someone's ideas or someone's approach. You know, we often think about it in a intimate relationship context. But Black feminists have sort of critiqued the use of the concept, which, you know, has often focused on individual relationships and sort of helped us or encouraged us to think of systemic forms of gaslighting that sort of undermine vulnerable individuals' perceptions of their situation, but also deny systemic forms of oppression. And so that again, going back to that quote, it's persistent, but it's not a problem, you know, kind of is a way of the institution gaslighting victims to say this isn't a problem. You know, it is a problem for victims, and victims have been trying to, you know, raise this as a consistent and persistent problem for decades. And so for when institutions come out with statements like we have zero tolerance for sexual violence, that's a form of institutional gaslighting. It's not only it's not only sort of undermining victims' statements of their experience, but it's also erasing and instead presenting this sort of institutional, that the institution is fine, that everything is working.
Even though it very well is probably not. Yeah. And so accepting these particular narratives is probably not going to help anything going forward. So given that you have analyzed in a lot of detail kind of what is happening with how this is being talked about and the problems with it, what recommendations do you have about how this topic of military sexual violence should or could be covered in the future better?
Yeah, so I have a whole chapter. So the book is actually written very differently from other books I've written in the sense that I, of course, I'm interested in engaging with other academics, but I really wanted journalists to read this book. I wanted policymakers to read this book. And I have a whole chapter on sort of recommendations and really specific getting into the details. And the first one, I guess, is really around language. I think we should definitely move away from the term sexual misconduct, for example. And I mean, it may not seem important, but for me, the term sexual misconduct, which is used in the Canadian context, was used in the Australian context, moves away from sort of the legal terms of sexual violence or sexual harassment and sort of places sexual violence as a just another form of military misconduct rather than a form of violence, sort of centering victims rather than the institution. I do think that language matters, and I think the way we collect data matters. So I think one of the recommendations I make is just actually collecting better data so that we understand the scope of the problem, providing outlets like anonymous surveys to service members, which is a great outlet to allow victims to report sexual violence that they may not have reported formally. I also provide sort of a set of media guidelines. So for example, I really emphasize, I use the concept of rape myths and build on research that was done in the civilian context to look at sort of what are the dominant rape myths, which would include sort of she was asking for it and, you know, women were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that work in the civilian context was really important in changing how the media covered sexual assault. So for example, newspaper articles now don't talk about what a victim was wearing. It's no longer considered appropriate. So similarly, I think based on the rape myths we have on sexual violence in the military, I think we should have different sets of recommendations that the media follows. So one, I don't think that media coverage should center the reputation of the military or the perpetrator. So this would include not mentioning the alleged perpetrator's years of service. And we see that persistently in media coverage. So it's sort of the good guy defense that this emphasis on, for example, how many times a service member may have toured in Iraq, or their rank, or any honors that they may have received. And rank might be useful in sort of clarifying, any abuse of power, but how many deployments a service member has had certainly should not be referenced in a media article. And again, sort of helps reinforce this idea of exceptionality, I think, in a way that's not helpful. Another recommendation I make is to not try and find women who do not have an experience of sexual violence and to get sort of a balanced perspective. And we see this particularly in the New York Times over the years when there have been particularly high profile cases. The New York Times would often call on women to provide quotes that sort of indicate, I didn't have this experience of sexual violence. This is not my experience. And I think these, maybe these statements are designed for sort of an alternative view, but ultimately they undermine and they gaslight victims. And they sort of perpetuate this idea that victims of sexual violence are unique or sort of outside of the norm. Another kind of recommendation I make is not to publish military press releases verbatim. And I know that sort of seems obvious, but sometimes, especially given the pressures of journalists right now, the military really uses the media kind of strategically. And I think it's important that we have good reporters who know the military context well and can ask follow-up questions and understand the full context, that they talk to academics or other knowledgeable sources to sort of provide a balanced context to any military press release. And then another sort of, you know, important one is to not use the term zero tolerance. And I do talk quite a lot about the use of zero tolerance in media coverage and how in all three contexts we have many cases in the Canadian context, over 40 uses of zero tolerance by senior military leaders over the course of the three decades. And these are just often after a scandal or high profile case, you have leaders come out and say, oh, we have zero tolerance. And it's a way of saying we're handling this. But actually there is no zero tolerance policy. There's clearly no zero tolerance is not a thing. I mean, there's quite high, you know, and if we want to think about it that way, there's quite high tolerance. We have a lot of examples of a lack of accountability for perpetrators. And I think it's a rhetoric that gaslights victims. You know, it's out of line with what victims are saying in terms of their experience of sexual violence. So those are a few of the recommendations that I make.
I think they're really important ones. And I'm glad you highlighted the point of kind of some of the audiences that this book is for. I think there's a lot in it for academics, but definitely as well beyond that. And even just that list there of things that the media can do better are really quite clear and concrete, and therefore hopefully quite helpful to people who might be reading this. Thankfully, they can read it because the book is out. It is available for people to go get their hands on, which means it's off your desk. So is there anything you might be working on now or next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, so I've been working on a few things. So I've actually been working with a team looking at the New Zealand Defense Forces, and that's another country that I've lived in, and really looking at how, the ongoing efforts to integrate gender, not just integrate women into defense forces, but to really take gender seriously in terms of how the defense forces operate, how they're changing their culture. So I've been working with a team there and doing really interesting surveys with service members and getting access to, how things work internally. So that's been quite interesting. I've been working on a project for a very long time that I sort of hate to even talk about it because it reminds me how long I've been working. But essentially with a couple of other researchers, we interviewed the first cohort of women to be integrated into the U.S. U.S. infantry roles. So that was back in 2016 when the policy changed in 2013 to allow women to fully serve and formally, officially in combat roles. We interviewed some members. We interviewed, I think, 22 members of the first class. And then we followed up and interviewed them each year for 5 years just to sort of see what was their experience being the first class, being, you know, new to combat roles? How were they received? What were any obstacles or successes they've had? So that's been a really interesting and long-term project, as you can sort of imagine. And we finished the five-year, we finished the fifth-year interviews, and we're just sort of looking at writing that up as a book. And that's sort of been an epic project, but one that, wow, I've enjoyed.
And a really important one. So hopefully both of those projects might become books. We can have you back and you can tell us all about them. but while you focus on writing them up, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, Good Soldiers Don't Rape, The Stories We Tell About Military Sexual Violence, published by Cambridge University Press. Megan, thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.